what happens when your boss says something that dishonors God or spreads lies about Christianity? Or what if your company strongly discourages you from talking about religion? Should you protest or keep quiet? Find out next on Grace to You. You know, it seems like there are more and more restrictions on what you can and cannot say about your faith, not just in public schools and government settings, but even within private companies. If evangelism isn't prohibited outright, it's often at least frowned upon. So how do you go about telling others about Christ when it may cost you your job? Well, that's John MacArthur's focus on today's Grace to You. In the final lesson from the series, Singing the Lord's Song in a Strange Land. The message you're about to hear may change you entirely and change your outlook about your job and on your responsibilities in the workplace when you see your work as given by God for His purposes and His honor. With that said, here's John MacArthur to bring today's lesson.
1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. Now here Peter moves from governmental authority, national authority, federal authority, state authority, police, to the social order in which we work, the labor environment. And he is saying it is very important how you conduct yourself there as well if you're going to silence the critics and lead people to Christ and if you're going to avoid discrediting Christianity. The mandate for submission is simply this: be submissive to your masters. If you're working for someone, submit to him. It is of little consequence to us what happens in this world. It is of little consequence whether you are a manager or a vice president. It is of little consequence whether you get another 50 cents raise or not, if it means that in the process of protesting your condition, you lose your testimony. Then it becomes of major consequence. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do everything that is provided within the employee proper channels to gain whatever would be fair. What I am saying is you never violate the standards. You never go outside of those things. You never disobey your employer. You submit, and it says it. Be submissive to your masters with all fear, and the fear is to God who put you there, and you should fear ever to discredit him. Doesn't matter whether your master is good and gentle or whether he is utterly unreasonable. The Apostle Paul said that the believer is to be obedient to his master. He is to be obedient to him with the right kind of behavior, that is doing exactly what he says. He says that you are to do it with fear and trembling because you hold God in awe who will punish your disobedience. He says you are to do it with singleness of heart. What does that mean? Loyalty. You are to be a loyal employee, conscientious. He says in Ephesians 6, you are to do it as unto Christ. You are to do it with the right motive. He says you are to do it not with eye service as men pleasers. In other words, not doing it just when the manager is looking and seeing you work, but doing it all the time knowing God always sees you. And then he says in Ephesians 6, you're to do it with a ready mind. What does that mean? Anxious, willing, eager. You're there early. You're so anxious to get to work. You see, let me give it to you bottom line. Not one person in this place has a secular job. You understand that? You do not have a secular job. All you have is a mission field. That's all you have. You don't have a secular job. You have a spiritual calling. And your calling is to reach the people where God has placed you. And you never do anything to demonstrate anger, hostility, dissatisfaction, discontent, pride, ego, selfishness. We all offer every day spiritual sacrifices to God in our work. And we are called to evangelize. And so we must submit and show that we are dutiful and faithful and loyal and obedient and conscientious and anxious and willing, and that we serve our employer as if we were serving Christ. And you know what happens? As a result, your testimony overwhelms them. You silence the critics. They have no way to discredit Christianity, and you'll bring some of the critics to Christ. Now let's go to the second point. The mandate to the motive. Verse 19. So simple. For this finds favor. That's it. That's the motive. Why should we do that? For this finds favor. Literally, the Greek says, this is a grace. This is a grace. What does that mean? An act which is intrinsically attractive to God. This finds favor with God. This pleases God. Look at the end of verse 20. Again, the same phrase. This finds favor with God. This is a grace. The idea is that when you work like that, it is admirable. It is worthy of gratitude. It is worthy of thanks. To whom? To God. To God. It is an act which makes, can you believe this? God grateful. It makes God grateful. And what is it that makes him grateful? Verse 19. If for the sake of consciousness of God. This is a better way to translate that. If for the sake of consciousness of God, a man bears up or endures under sorrows when suffering unjustly. Now here's a guy in the workplace, and he's a slave. And in the Roman world, he might be getting whipped unjustly. He might be getting deprived of his food unjustly. He might be working long hours beyond what is reasonable unjustly. He might be punished in a number of ways unjustly. But if, for the sake of his consciousness of God, he endures all of those sorrows, God is thankful. Did you get that? What pleases God? When you protest, when you strike, when you picket, when you walk out? No. What pleases God? What finds favor with him is when you bear up under the sorrows that come when you suffer unjustly. That pleases God. You notice, if for the sake of consciousness of God, the use of synecdoche here in the construction with the genitive makes it better to say consciousness of God. That's what it means, because you're aware of God's presence. Because you're aware God is watching. Because you're aware God is there. It is used in a similar construction for you Bible students in Hebrews 10:2. But your action is prompted by a conscious sense of God's presence. You know he's there. You know he's watching. And so you endure. The word sorrow implies pain. You are suffering unjustly. But you never falter in your witness. You accept it. You accept it in humility, in patience, trusting God, confident of his total control. You accept it. That pleases God. God wants to see that. He is pleased to see that. Now, painful, unjust beatings were being endured, no doubt, by some of the people reading this epistle or hearing it read. They were being beaten as slaves by those who were taking advantage of them. And this is very practical, and it was far worse than anything you have ever known. They owned these slaves. There was no such thing as freedom. They couldn't change jobs. They had no labor union. There was no recourse. There were no employee counselors. There was no one to go to. There was no Better Business Bureau. There were no civil lawsuits open to them against employers. And so they had to take it. But they did. Peter says you did right if you did, because you kept the testimony of the power of salvation to give a man an unquenchable peace and faith in God no matter what happens. You see, what they have to see is that you're unflappable, that you're immovable, that your faith is strong and your courage is great. And no matter what happens in that environment, you stand in the peace of God, totally trusting Him. In a quiet spirit, with a patient heart, loyal, dutiful, faithful, diligent, willing, anxious to be the best employee you can be. Then Peter expands the thought with a negative and positive statement in verse 20. He says, "For what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience?" Well, there's no credit. I mean, that's the implied answer. What credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? You deserve it. You ought to endure it with patience. There's no particular virtue in that. If you sinned and you're being punished because of something you did, then there's no virtue in taking it patiently. But, on the other hand, if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, here's the statement again, this is a grace to God. This finds favor with God. God isn't particularly pleased when you're patient and you deserve the pain. God is very pleased when you're patient and you don't deserve it. Some of you have employment situations that are not fair. Some of you are enduring suffering. The Greek here literally says you are harshly treated. And it uses a verb, kalafidzein, which means to punch with the fist. It sometimes means to cuff, to slap, or to fist around. Not just once, but to beat roughly. So used in Mark 14:65. Beating of slaves was common. And he says if you're being fisted, slapped, cuffed, battered, beaten up roughly, and you deserve it, then your patience is no virtue. But if you don't, your patience pleases God. So the reason, the motive for endurance, what's the motive for us? It pleases God to see us accept the earthly difficulty with complete faith in Him. That is a testimony beyond all testimonies. You want to have a testimony at work? That's how. And He is speaking of very severe treatment. As we shall see in a moment, very severe treatment. This thought, by the way, is repeatedly in Peter's mind. Look at chapter 3, verse 14. "But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. Do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled." If they beat you up and you're doing what is right and noble and excellent, you're blessed. Look at chapter 4, verse 14. "If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed." You are blessed. Verse 16, "If you suffer as a Christian, don't be ashamed, but in that name let Him glorify God." You're blessed. Why? Because it pleases God. And when God is pleased, what does He do? He blesses. Now, if you want to short-circuit the blessing, then retaliate, threaten, react. Stop being submissive to your employer, and you'll cut off the blessing of God. Or you may get what you want in the natural, but you will forfeit what God would give you in the supernatural. This isn't new. This isn't new at all. Where did Peter learn this? Well, how about Matthew 5:11? "Blessed are you when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is," what's the word? "Great." Great. Can you have a heavenly view, or do you have to have it all now? You say, "I want that promotion, I want that wage, I want what I want my employee rights." You want it now or you want it forever? No, Jesus laid it out as marvelously and simply as he could. Great will your reward be in heaven. God does not forget. He does not forget. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4, to this present hour we are both hungry and thirsty. We are poorly clothed. We are roughly treated. We are homeless. And we toil, working with our own hands. When we are reviled, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure. When we are slandered, we try to conciliate. Wow. Amazing. That's the way to live. You say, why'd you live like that, Paul? Why don't you demand your rights? Why don't you say, you can't do that to me? I don't want to demand my rights. I want to show how I trust God. I want to show that there's nothing that people can do to me to make me break my trust in God. I want to show that there's nothing people can do to me to make me lose my peace and my joy and my confidence and my hope in God. And when people see that I live that transcendent life, then Christianity becomes believable. And then an amazing statement comes in verse 21. Absolutely amazing. Verse 21, for you have been called for this purpose. Whoa. You have been called for this purpose? What does he mean called? Salvation call. Salvation call is exactly what he means. Go back to verse 9. Him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That's salvation. So when you were saved to this purpose. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Well, you've been called, by the way, uses the same term in chapter 5, verse 10. It says, God who called you to his eternal glory. So Peter uses it in the reference of salvation. He is saying, when you were saved for this purpose. What purpose? What purpose? Here it is. To patiently endure suffering you do not deserve. That's right. You were called to that. You were called to that. You say, how come? Because as soon as you became a Christian, you became the enemy of the world. And so you will, as you live out your Christian life, be unjustly and unfairly attacked. You live out your Christian life in your environment, the system will resent you and come against you. But they will look to you as the model employee, so they're trapped. You should be better than anybody else. And in the process, some critics will be silenced and some critics will be saved. That's what you've been called to. That's what you've been called to. This isn't anything that should surprise you. When I was in college as a student studying, and I was an athlete in college, involved in all the athletics in my college, and I wanted a summer job one summer. So I applied to the YMCA of Glendale to run one of their youth programs in an elementary school playground. And I passed all of the athletic skill tests without any kind of a problem. And they brought me into a board of six people in the Glendale City Hall and sat me down for the psychological evaluation. They asked me, what is the most important value in your life? I said, my personal relationship to Jesus Christ. And everybody just sort of gasped. And they asked me some question along the line, is this something you feel you have to propagate? My response was, I live to propagate this. I don't have any other purpose than to propagate this. Needless to say, I flunked the psychological evaluation. The last thing they wanted was somebody evangelizing the kids. And we're talking, folks, about 1960s. It isn't really any different now, maybe worse. But when you're out there, and I'm sure if I were to leave the ministry and try to get a job anyplace and tell them what I really believe, I would be unemployed permanently because I would pose such a threat. I would have to work for a Christian company, and I'd probably drive them nuts trying to straighten out their theology. You see, you were saved to this end. You were saved to this purpose. And what happens if Christians rebel? What happens if Christians retaliate? What happens if they fight and strike and demand their rights? You know what that says to the lost world? Hey, we care about this life. We live for this life, and we resent you, and you're not treating us right, and we're going to fight you. And it would also say, hey, God hasn't done anything to get us this deal, so we're going after it ourselves. We wouldn't be any different than them, would we? I hate to see hostile, angry Christians trying to get their square inch in this society. Who cares? You were called to this, to suffer undeservedly and to endure it with patience. 2 Timothy 3:12 says, all that live godly in this present age shall suffer persecution. It goes with the territory. That's how it is. And you don't want to cave into it. The motive pleases God. It pleases God, who will bless you. Thirdly, the model. Who's the model? Since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he didn't revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. What did Christ do? He was reviled. He was persecuted. He was slandered. He suffered. What did he do? Did he retaliate? Not at all. He answered not a word at his trial. In meekness and humility, committed himself to God. And so Peter says, Christ suffered for you, not only redemptively, but in an exemplary way. Not only did he suffer to redeem, but he suffered to set the model for how you're to live. Beyond the redemptive work of the cross is the pattern of the suffering of Christ. The word example, hupagrammos, it means a copy. It's the model for the letters that the children write. The pattern. He set the pattern for you to follow in his steps. The word steps is footprint. He left a line of footprints, a line of tracks in the dirt for you to walk in, same way. When he was reviled, he didn't revile back. When he was slandered, he didn't slander back. When he suffered, he uttered no threats. He just committed himself to God. You think you have rights? Ha! Huh. They couldn't touch the rights that he had. And he asked for none of them. That's how we're to live, as servants in the world.
You're listening to John MacArthur, author, pastor, and president of the Master's College and Seminary, both schools in Southern California. Today's lesson was a part of John MacArthur's practical study, Singing the Lord's Song in a Strange Land, right here on Grace to You. Hi, John. You've been in pastoral ministry for more than four decades now. I'm wondering how often you've seen today's principle put into action, God using the testimony of obedient, submissive, maybe even obscure Christians in powerful ways.
Oh, I've seen that all my life. That's how evangelism is done. That's the impact of the living church in the world. Look, I'm on radio. And I'm happy to be here teaching the Word of God, proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ, and on television, and on CDs and tapes and MP3s. That's the message. But what makes that message believable is the testimony of believers who have gone through very difficult trials and come out the other side with not only a strengthened faith, but a confidence in the reality of that faith. You know, the New Testament even says that when your faith is tested and comes out refined, the benefit to you is that you know you have the real thing because it stood the test of time and the test of trial. Not only do you know that, but everybody around you knows that. So singing the Lord's song in a strange land, which is the series we've been doing, is really the common testimony of believers that shows the power of salvation in that believer's life. When everything goes well, everything goes good, you have everything you want, that is not so much a convincing testimony to an unbeliever of the validity of salvation. But when things go badly and things go wrong and disappointments and trials and heartaches and persecution come and you go through that singing the Lord's song in this strange world, that is a strong testimony. You can win the response of an unbeliever to the evidence of salvation in a trial far more easily than in the good times. There is a CD album available to you on this subject, singing the Lord's Song in a Strange Land. You may have listened to the series. You may have hit and missed through the series or just catching it today. Get a copy of this or download it on gty.org. And for even more study, get a look at the commentary I've written on 1 Peter, one of 29 on the New Testament.
The title of the study again, Singing the Lord's Song in a Strange Land. Work toward being an effective witness for Christ in a world that's sinful, sometimes hostile, and certainly lost. Get your copy as you contact us today. The study, Singing the Lord's Song in a Strange Land, is available as a 6-CD album. The cost is $27 and shipping is free. The CDs are an ideal resource to give someone preparing for a new job or simply wondering how to witness to their neighbors. To order, call toll-free 1-800-55-GRACE or place your order from the Grace to You website at any time. Go online to gty.org. The MP3s are also available free of charge at gty.org. The title to look for, Singing the Lord's Song in a Strange Land. And another superb resource is the MacArthur Study Bible. It has nearly 25,000 footnotes that help you unlock the meaning of virtually every passage. It's from the foretelling of Jesus' first coming to the prophecies about his second coming, from Genesis to Revelation and everything in between. Several editions to choose from. Just ask about the Study Bible when you call 1-800-55-GRACE or look for them online at gty.org. And now for John MacArthur and the staff, I'm Carl Miller, wishing you a great weekend and reminding you that Grace to You television is available Sundays on DirecTV Channel 378 or watch it online at gty.org. And please come back Monday for a new week of Unleashing God's Truth, one verse at a time, right here on Grace to You. We're all on one of two roads, the narrow path towards salvation or the broad path leading to destruction. So how do you know where you're traveling? Find out next week on Grace to You.